Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin River Outings, providing canoe and kayak rentals for first-timers and experienced paddlers. Experience the Wisconsin and Kickapoo Rivers for a few hours or a few days. canoe-camping.com/WPR. Wisconsin Public Radio helps make sense of the day's news. From headlines to investigative reporting, you can count on WPR for thoughtful, accurate coverage. National, international, and Wisconsin news. Listen on the air and online at WPR.org.
As more than 2.5 million American soldiers return from serving in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, rates of suicide and post-traumatic stress among veterans are climbing. We will talk with a guest this hour who argues that beyond the trauma of war, soldiers are grappling with moral injuries that they need society's help in facing. We'll talk about those moral injuries and how civilians, how we can play a role in helping heal them. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Did you serve our country in any wars or conflicts? Do you think you experienced moral injury in the process? As a civilian, perhaps, what do you mean when you say thank you for your service? Is that thank you enough? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Nancy Sherman, a university professor at Georgetown University in the Department of Philosophy, former Guggenheim Fellow. She served as the inaugural Distinguished Chair in Ethics at the United States Naval Academy. She is the author of several books about war and soldiers, most recently, After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. And she joins us from the studio at Georgetown University. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So, what is a moral wound?
A moral wound is a sense that you've been violated or you've violated someone's moral norms, and war is a place ripe for those injuries. You worry whether your war was just, whether your conduct was just, whether you could have done more and better to save your buddy, whether you could have avoided that collateral incident that killed a child, why you're not coming home with all your troops when you're always told, take a bullet for each other and bring your buddies home. So all of that plays on the psyche in really tough ways, and there's so much moral ambiguity in war that a lot of it just sits in a murky mess that needs our help in figuring out.
How does moral injury differ from PTSD, which is the more traditional way to think of psychological damage from war?
Right. Well, PTSD is a diagnosis that came out around 1980, largely in response to the Vietnam War, but also what women were going through who were victims of sexual assault and rape. And it was, the idea was, let's legitimate the psychological anguish. There's a life threat out there, and you respond to that life threat with hypervigilance, a kind of flashback often in dreams and awful nightmares, or you just withdraw. Well, moral injury isn't about fear necessarily. You could be worried that you're afraid for your life, but it's about, the feelings aren't so much fear but guilt and shame, a sense of betrayal, mistrust of perhaps the American people or your leaders. So it's a different array of moral emotions, and often they have to do with holding yourself and other people responsible. So they're emotions of moral responsibility that play hard on the psyche.
Yeah. Are these moral injuries, these moral wounds, in bigger numbers today than they were, say, after Vietnam, or for that matter, after World War II?
That's a great question, and you know, we haven't operationalized the term fully, and so aren't doing the statistics or demographics. The move is in part to recognize that the phenomena are diverse, and that a kind of artificial diagnosis, or just one diagnosis doesn't fit all those coming home. So we don't have a good sense, but many of those I talk to and many who show up in the VA or in Defense Department hospitals are saying that they feel this awful guilt they can't quite get to. Or if you use the term moral injury, it just resonates. Ah, that's what I'm feeling. I can't figure out this stuff. I feel so ashamed or so angry at betrayals.
Yeah. Are there any factors that would make a person more prone to moral injury?
You know, again, we're just sort of doing the research, but some of it is that we have to remember we take very young people into war, and war is filled with, there aren't any good solutions. One option is worse than the next. So, and if we come in with a very black and white mentality, which is often the sign of youth, but also lofty military ideals can encourage that, you really get stuck when you have to choose the lesser of two evils or face things you hadn't thought about before. So that's a proclivity, I think, youth and a kind of real rigid black and white mentality, which does characterize a lot of service members going in.
You write that moral wounds demand moral healing. So what is moral healing?
Well, moral healing really is connecting with yourself and with other people in ways that hold us to account. So I write sort of thank you for your service, that ritual that we see and hear so often in airports and as a greeting. You know, in some ways is a response to Vietnam, but it doesn't really engage and help build the trust and, oh, you get what I've been through, or you're really empathetic. So some of moral healing really are the kinds of emotions and interactions that can undo that sense of feeling it's all the weight is on my shoulder. And so that can be reaching out through empathy. It can be having a kind of hope in each other. Sometimes, you know, it's a gifted relationships, and those can be in your family. Those can be in the classroom, which I've discovered. Or they, of course, can be in a therapy setting where you go without stigma and you come out feeling really kind of renewed. But they don't go away easily. These kinds of wounds about leaving buddies behind or just not understanding whether killing in war is defensible. Last a long time, and the scars build up too.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring a caller in because it's you just kind of referred to something he wants to bring up. Ray in Milwaukee, go ahead.
Refer to Gandhi. Gandhi, when there was horrible violence in India, a Muslim man came to Gandhi and said, "I think I'm going to kill myself because I think I've killed a Hindu child." And Gandhi responded, "Do not kill yourself. You're not helping anybody by doing that, but what you can do is go and find a Hindu child who's an orphan and raise him as a Hindu." And that's what he's telling a Muslim man, to raise this child as a Hindu. So some of these soldiers coming back might think they've killed a woman, a mother, or a child, and there is nothing we can do as civilians to help them get over that guilt, but they can themselves reach out to orphanages in Iraq and Afghanistan, and by trying to help raise the children that were left orphans, they can help heal themselves.
That's a wonderful example of healing by finding children who are helpless in a way and bringing a sense of light and glimmer of hope to them. That's one way. I do think we too can play a really important role, and I see it in the classroom, and I see it in my own work and that of others, just bridging the mill-sieve divide. It's huge, it's artificial, and soldiers are citizen soldiers, they're civilians. So I do think our own outreach and meaningful engagements also can play just that kind of role. There's many, many different avenues.
Yeah. You know, Ray didn't say it on the air, but he said he was conflicted by the conversation when he spoke with my producer, that these soldiers feel guilty because they killed someone, and that is war, and that is what they signed up for.
You know, you said what's proclivity to, or are you more inclined to feel moral wound if you've had a certain kind of background or not? Well, one is, I do think many of those who sign up really don't understand both theoretically and really concretely what killing in war is. If it feels deeply, deeply unjustified and just like a kind of murder, then they shouldn't be in that business. On the other hand, I do think some thinking about what counts as just killing in war and how it's different from murder because of the nature of the defense or the cause is just and you're not killing gratuitously and very discriminately, that's really different. But up close is always different than a classroom. And there's no way of getting around that. And for some killing, even the most justified killing in war, be it World War II, World War I, or this war, can absolutely unmoor you. So I understand that.
We are talking with the author of After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. Nancy Sherman is a university professor at Georgetown University in the Department of Philosophy. And we welcome your questions for her. We welcome your views on this. We welcome any experiences that you have. Did you or someone you know serve our country in wars or conflicts? Did they experience moral injury in the process? What do you think your role is as a civilian to help our soldiers heal? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about healing the moral injuries in our American soldiers. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, Nancy Sherman, who is the author of After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. She talked with many individual soldiers about their moral injuries and how they were able to heal. And we, before we take a call, Professor Sherman, I wanted to talk a little bit. Our caller before our break seemed a little bit as though, you know, the soldier should heal thyself by, you know, helping others to get over the guilt of the killing of war. What about civilians, perhaps, Ray, who did not morally support the recent wars? Are they obligated to support our soldiers? And I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you to start again because I didn't have your volume up. Go ahead.
After the Vietnam War, we really, I think, in these past 30, 40 years have separated the war from the warrior. So part of that greeting, thank you for your service, is agnostic, if you like, to whether you supported the war or not. And I do think all of us are collectively responsible for our service members, whether we supported the war or didn't, or had various views in these 15 years. They are us. They come from us, and they go out representing us, and they come home. And we have responsibilities to make those homecomings really a place where they can feel at home again and not be considered alien or separate. And that just goes in all sorts of ways. The agenda of the war really doesn't have to matter, I think. For many, it doesn't matter, and that's regrettable. That is, for many who serve, because I think we do need to think about what we're serving for and not just that we're going to bring home each other's buddy, each other's mate. But as civilians, this really means these having friendships that cross the line. It's a little like breaking out of your in-group and viewing and coming to understand that if someone's in camis, they really have not arrived from another planet. They're on your planet. And it sounds bizarre, but I know so many people on so many campuses who just never know how to talk to a fellow student who has come home from war and may still be in their camis. So that's really what I'm talking about.
Yeah, in the book, you tell the story of a veteran who said to a civilian, "Don't just thank me for my service, say please first." What is the message of say please first?
Well, it was enigmatic, but the anger in that room was unmistakable. And I think that veteran meant, think about what you're sending us to and why. And so when you beat the war drums, think harder about why those war drums are being beaten. And if you are going to send us, then you often are in a better position than we are once we're deployed to understand if that war should continue to be waged or not. So I think that's what it is. You are a part of those that wage war and those who can be held accountable for it. And that was a really powerful message. We are the people, and we are the collective nation to whom our citizen soldiers return.
Here's an email from a listener named Dean. He writes, "I served 2 years in Iraq. There isn't a day that goes by that I wonder if I could have done more or something different. I also had feelings of betrayal and neglect while we were over there. And when we returned to the States, you were forbidden by the military to seek help. If you did go to the doctor for these problems, you were cut off and disciplined." A reaction? Well,
that's really upsetting, and that's what the military has been fighting against for 15 years, and we hope they're beginning to break the stigma of seeking mental health. The best place or the best way to break that stigma is for leaders themselves to take their subordinates and peers in hand and say, look, you're hurting, and this is a way to get help, and it won't count against you or your record. It's not a sign of weakness, and it's not a sign of malingering. Unfortunately, it's such, the stigma is so deep, and for leaders, the fear in themselves to seek help can be so great. But we're slowly beginning to break that, and the more conversations we have, the more buddies take their buddies to therapy or learn how to open up, even in their relationships, because healing begins from inside out. One-on-one connecting is really the way to begin to erode the stigma and also break down the walls. These are deep walls of shame, and as he said, the sense that he had been neglected and betrayed, as well as guilty that he didn't do enough and could have done better and should have done better. Those are such common feelings; they're ubiquitous.
You told the story of one veteran in after war who felt these feelings of guilt and shame and responsibility for his it was like survivor's guilt. He came home and his buddies did not. And he was dealing with those issues and getting some, you know, medical treatment while still in the military when he returned stateside. And his supervisors were really giving him a hard time, you know, not liking that he was taking time off for medical appointments, telling him he'd have to come in, you know, like 5:30 in the morning, super early to make up for lost time. And you're saying that that type of thing is changing. That's not the case anymore.
Well, it's case by case by case. That was a case of someone I know very well named Lalo Paniagua, and he was a Marine who really was slowly disintegrating. It's the best way to put it. And he has this remarkable wife, Donna, who got him to seek help. But it was blocked at every stage, and that was at Quantico, which is itself a Marine base, where his supervisor thought he was malingering and that he couldn't really be a real Marine if he had to go to appointments every morning. Now, it turned out in that case, there was a superior who stepped in and said, look, the main job for this Marine is to get better. And he was pulled from that base and put on a different base at Walter Reed Hospital for a wounded warrior battalion, where he did remarkably well, and that was a 3 or 4 month period. So sometimes it takes a very aggressive superior to step in and see that there's a subordinate who may even, you know, have a lot of power, who's blocking the progress of healing and getting soldiers whole again.
I'm Dre Cardine talking with Nancy Sherman, author of After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. We welcome questions or experiences for her at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dan in Franksville is with us. Hi, Dan.
Howdy. Well, I'm a Vietnam-era vet. I didn't see anything real terrible, but I hope I'm doing something right. I have a little different approach. I usually tell them that they didn't do what they did. I mean, when I only do this, sometimes I see people like they're super desperate. I think they're going to do something bad to themselves or someone else or whatever. One specifically was a World War II vet, and then the other one was a Vietnam, and there were some other ones. But I remember I told them that they didn't do that. I said they were co-opted. Their minds were co-opted by powerful political people in Washington. I says they did what you didn't do it. They co-opted your mind. I says would you do that stuff when you were born, when you were a young man and stuff like that? Would you do that kind of behavior? You know. So I work on them like that, and I tell them you thought you did it, but you didn't do it. I says that's the physical part of you might have did it, but when you're in the just in boot camp, moral reality goes out the window, because otherwise you can't do something that's totally unnatural.
Well, I agree with some of what you say, and not all of it. Vietnam was a different era. In part, there's conscription. We don't have conscription right now. But whatever the war is, soldiers don't give up their individual consciences when they serve. There's a lot of socialization and there's a lot of pressure, but there always is a moral conscience. And the fact that our service members feel so much moral anguish about all sorts of things, buddies, survivor guilt, collateral incidents, the war, corrupt warlords, shady partners, you name it, leaving their kids behind, infidelities. That means that they haven't parked their conscience outside the gate. And the real struggle is that they go with their consciences. And by the way, they have to blow whistles, or they ought to blow whistles when they see torture or the like. And that doesn't come easy. That brings its whole other set of moral weight and burden. It's not easy to object and to point out to a senior advisor, senior commander, that what they're ordering you to do is unjust or immoral. So I guess I disagree at bottom. But that said, there's a lot of responsibility to go around. No shortage of it.
Yeah. And even if soldiers would take Dan's advice and just say it wasn't me, the government did this to me, there's still going to be that anger and betrayal, feelings of anger and betrayal at your government.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or, you know, or a citizenry that wasn't active enough in protesting.
Yeah.
Yep.
Kathy in Verona is with us. Hello, Kathy.
Hi. I live with a veteran, and we've been in a relationship for over 5 years. And I wonder, since I was never in the military, how do I convey a sense of empathy? I feel like it's more like sympathy. I hear the things that he went through, the carnage that he saw, and I just feel like if we haven't been there, if we have never been in the military, how can we... And I feel that they feel that way, too, that they feel sort of like, how can you even understand what I've been through?
Well, here I take a page from a wonderful colleague and author, Phil Klei, who wrote Redeployment. And he said, you know, don't just tell me that you don't understand what I've been through. And he was saying this to a friend whose sister had been sexually assaulted. I think it's a defense and a resistance both on the part of the military service member and family members to think they can't go there or can't understand. And that kind of dance just builds up walls. It's very, very, very slow, though, as you undoubtedly know. And you're right. There's got to be a lot of sympathy and compassion, as well as attunement, which is what empathy is, trying to be in sync. And the bottom line is there has to be trust to open up. And I know, I just came back from visiting Lalo and Donna, and they've been married for 5 years, so 5 years together, and it's been a slow process of him opening up to her and she understanding the details. And some of it just comes in small titrations, and but knowing that you're each there and having wisdom on both sides, I think, is really what's key. So I think the civilian-military borders sometimes are just too artificial, and I'm for breaking them down.
Mm-hmm. Kathy?
Thank you very much. I sure know what you're going through, and it's not an easy haul, and I just hope there's a larger community supporting you.
Yeah. The VA has been wonderful, I can say that.
That's good. That's really good.
Is she one of the few that can say that, Nancy?
Well, you know, these are large systems. Yeah. I was in a car the other day and heard, "You are caller number 20. Mm. Please wait." That from the VA, that is, to change an appointment. And, you know, and then my vet friend said, "And I will kill myself as I wait."
Oh, yeah.
Meaning, yeah. Joking. It was a funny ritual. Mm. On the other hand, you know, there are glimmers of hope. Mental health professionals are scarce these days, and the VA is our largest national health service. So it moves slowly and it moves cumbersomely. And I guess part of a message about moral injury is that it doesn't fit in just kind of one box where one kind of treatment is the right kind. Cognitive behavioral therapy, used a lot to decondition fear and stress, may not be the right thing when you're feeling like you've been betrayed, or as our caller said, neglected, or you have survivor guilt. You may have to not just expose yourself to the threat, but talk it through and understand in a very different way, and also build relationships.
Kathy, thank you very much
yes.
for calling. Let's move
now to
John in La Crosse. Hi, John.
Good morning. Interesting topic. And I'm calling as a person from another era, way back in the late 40s and early 50s, when Korea, the Korean conflict, was in process. And like during World War II, millions of primarily young men were drafted. And they were essentially told shall we say, very simple language, that we need you, and you will come. We will train you to fight and to kill, and you will have very little say in terms of what you are assigned to do once it's time for you to go to work for us. Now, I was fortunate. I was not in combat, but I was one of the many draftees, just like the men in Stephen Ambrose's Citizen Soldier. And if you've been a part of the Veterans History Project, you know that many of those vets died a natural death, still afraid to deal with their demons from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Or
yeah.
the Korean
yeah.
War.
Right. Well, I should say here, I am a daughter of a World War II vet, and I know about those demons because my dad was 89 when he died, and it was 60 years or so, at least, 90 minus 20, 70 years, since he had come back to the on the Queen Mary, where he was a medic. And the day he died, I was asked to just clean up the hospital room, and I found in his pocket his dog tags. Now, I am the closest of daughters, but somehow I never saw them, and he never told me. So my dad carried his war and didn't really talk about it my whole childhood and my most of my adulthood until I went to the Naval Academy, and he started thinking, oh, I can talk to her now. And when I taught there. And so, yes, those wounds fester, and I think we're in a different generation. We're in a generation where it's safe, and it's even healthy for returning service members to talk to their family, not with gore and blood necessarily, but about the moral strains and, you know, what it's like. And we don't have to tiptoe around it, and I hope that society figures out, as we are, I think, that this is part of normalcy and the normalization of war. And so just as we're more open psychologically, I think, about our anguish across different domains here too, I think. I hope. That's the hope. And I certainly see it in the young generation of veterans coming home and what is brought into the classroom and what fellow students who haven't served can learn about it.
Yeah, thanks, John. You touched on it, but what does the lack of a draft, the volunteer nature of our military, how does that change the moral burden that soldiers deal with?
Well, you know, it's a million-dollar question. I don't think we will have conscription again very soon because we're shrinking the forces and the nature of the footprint that we have in war. There'll be small-scale, tip-of-the-spear special forces, et cetera. That said, I would think that national service across the board would be a very good way to understand what it is to serve collectively, not always in the cause that is of your choice, in a hierarchical system. So it does change the flavor. We have to understand 0.5% of the population only has served. So that's why, in some cases, they seem alien to us. So I do think it changes the complexion. The policy issues are too complex to even begin to tackle. But we're seeing some of the residue, no doubt, and the moral residue.
Here's a provocative email from Jennifer. I completely disagree with your guest. I worked for the VA for 11 years. This is volunteer service. I have never seen a bigger group of people with such a sense of entitlement. We give veterans everything on a silver platter. We throw tons of money at their problems, and they don't improve. Both my grandfathers were in World War II, and they saw combat. They both came back to go to work and be productive members of society. I don't see that with current members.
Well, I think that's a big generalization, so I disagree with the writer. But I would say this. There are huge issues in bureaucratic health services like the VA about who's skimming and who's taking advantage of the system, who's using the VA not to get better but just as a staging place to get, or for example, using these warrior transition brigades that I mentioned in military hospitals. They're using them to get better ratings when they are medically retired. And that should be monitored. There's no doubt it should be monitored. But there are many, many, many who need the VA and do use it and do heal and aren't just taking advantage of the system. And I think sometimes our old-fashioned notions of what it was to do well and go out and go to work are inflated. My dad went out, did well, went to work, but I think he suffered, and it came out in bouts of anger and distemper that we saw, my mother saw certainly. And I'm not alone in being a child of that generation. And I think some of it was war incurred with kind of a little trail left behind that we didn't know how to figure out.
Nancy Sherman is a university professor at Georgetown University Department of Philosophy. She served as the inaugural Distinguished Chair in Ethics at the United States Naval Academy. She is the author of several books on war and soldiers. We are talking with her about her most recent, After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. And we welcome your questions. We welcome your experiences. Do you think you experienced moral injury in the process of serving our country in any war? Maybe mostly the most current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Nancy Sherman, author of After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. Our guest argues that beyond the trauma of war, soldiers are grappling with moral injuries, and they need our help in healing. And we are discussing what those moral injuries are and how our government and civilians should play a role in helping them. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lou in Columbus is with us. Hello, Lou.
Oh, hi, it's Will.
I'm sorry, Will. Go ahead.
That's all right. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to commend the author on opening up a subject that... it's probably 20, 30 years overdue, but I went through an unusual experience. I'm a Vietnam veteran, served with the Marines in Vietnam, 69 and 70, and things seemed to go along pretty well until the outbreak of the Iraq War, and I hit a rough spot and checked into the VA and received practically all the different types of treatments they offered, and I think they literally saved my life. But at the end of it all, I said, something is still missing. I'm still feeling this this dark spot in my heart. And I decided to go back to Vietnam, and that was in 2008. And I went back intending to go to the village that we had done some damage in. And I took along with me an album of photographs I had taken in 69 and 70. And when first thing I did when I got to the village is go to the Buddhist pagoda, and I was I met the senior nun at the Buddhist pagoda, and I told her, I said, I'm here to apologize. And she said, apologize for what? I said, for the war, for my part in it. I want to express my sorrow. It wasn't until I came home that I found out that it was unjust. It was based on lies. There are two major injustices. One's what we did to you. The other one is what our government did to us, the soldiers, who identified our lives as being less worth or value than those lives of men and women who were in college. I didn't explain that to her, but my feeling is that's the second big injustice of that war. And the nun simply laughed at me. She says, you know, we don't want your Western guilt in our village. We're glad you're here, but we're glad to offer you friendship and support. All we want is your generosity, and we accept your apology, and that's very meaningful. So that began a whole series of events that took me back to Vietnam another four times. And for the purpose of making restitution. I didn't know what I was doing. I just went back and found out that these photographs I had were the only photographs taken at the village for 20 years. And that was a form of restitution. But the whole world turned around for me once I went back and faced the Vietnamese face to face.
There we go.
Well, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I think you're right. Homecoming to our home has one kind of reconciliation, and your re-trauma with the Iraq era and Afghanistan era wars is not uncommon. The VA had surges in people going back because they got re-traumatized, and many have gone back to do healing, real healing work, and not just say I'm sorry in Vietnam. I interviewed Hugh Thompson once, who was the helicopter pilot who stopped the My Lai massacre, and that is what he did. He went back and he worked with children in Vietnam and had an experience much like yours. So thank you so much for those comments. Really, really meaningful. And meaningful healing comes in all different kinds of ways, including restorative justice in many senses. You know.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Lou. Will, thank you, Will.
Oh, I'm sorry, I said Lou, too, because I have that up. Will. So a color drop, but she says she knows a lot of her friends or people that she knows that had rough childhoods or had very few opportunities volunteering for military service, and she mm-hmm. wonders if mm-hmm. that is something that might lead to moral injury.
I think there's something there. We can't profile everyone or see what the pre-existing background conditions are, but for many, the military has always been a way out and a set of opportunities that you can't get otherwise through education or work and the like. And families can be rough, and you may need to find a new family called the Marine Corps or called the Army or the Navy or Air Force precisely for that reason, and that can set you up. It isn't the only cause, but yeah, you know, and again, I stress some of the work of growing up and of seeing how absolutely complex the world is something students have a chance to do when they're 18 to 22 at a university like Georgetown or even the Naval Academy, but not everyone has that option. And then you go to war and you see the worst of the worst choices. And you went in thinking there was glory, and there isn't much glory in war, really, at the bottom. It's overrated, as a journalist said to me, war journalist.
Yeah. Well, then speaking of which, can moral injury be prevented?
Well, I think it can, to some degree, or mitigated. Part of the reason we teach war ethics or the moral psychology of soldiering in the academies and basic ethics classes at liberal arts universities at Wisconsin and the like, or to ROTC students, is to be able to think in advance about hard choices that you're going to face. The same reason we see movies that have to deal with moral conflicts or read novels, All's Quiet on the Western Front or Soldier's Return, Melvin Bragg from Cumbria, England. Yeah, you get exposed. You rehearse, as the Stoics say. You pre-rehearse before you go. And that kind of moral thinking, opening the horizons sort of in imagination, does really good, hard work. But, you know, PowerPoints and 2 hours of a briefing about this is what suicide feels like, this is where you go, don't really get to your psyche. So often it's much more open conversation in the units about what you're going through and what you're seeing that can help mitigate some of this awful private sense of failure or distraught.
Ryan in Viroqua is with us. Hello, Ryan.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi. I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. He's there in 03 and 04. I've been dealing with PTSD for about 10 years when I came back. I want to say that the VA actually eventually, I was been in the VA system for about 10 years seeking help, and it took a long time to find the right psychiatrist and psychologist to help me work through the issues. Mm-hmm. So help is out there for those that are listening and are just stick with it. Eventually you can come out the other side, kind of like I have. And the comment I had was related to the previous commenter that said about previous trauma or something that happened in your childhood affecting things that happen in war and how you internalize them. And that's pretty much what my case was. I didn't get actual release. I worked through all sorts of trauma situations and specific events, and it gave me some relief here and there, but I really didn't let myself off the hook until I dealt with the thing that I was blaming myself for everything that bad happened that over there, even things I didn't do, but things that I saw. There's a part of my upbringing. I was raised extremely religious, and you're a sinner and everything is your fault. And pretty much I did the exact same thing in Iraq, and I internalized the entire war and made the entire war, put that all on my shoulders. And it took me 10 years to figure out that was the crux of it, that I wasn't responsible for all those dead kids and the families shot up at checkpoints. It wasn't, wasn't my fault.
Ryan, thank you so much, Ryan. You're just also saying that stick with it. And, the message is coming from folks like you who have faced these traumas, and also the kind of attitude that exacerbates it of, yeah, we do take on a lot, and some of our upbringings are harsher than others, and and the military is not, you know, is a zero defect place. That's their bureaucratic management style. If we got rid of that, we would do a lot better too. Put that on top of black and white morality, and it's really, really hard to not think that you were at fault. Thank you. I hope you spread your word to other guys and men and women that are suffering, because it's a really important message. I thank you so much, Ryan.
Yeah, Ryan, thank you so much. What I know it's individual, but do you have any advice for veterans who are struggling with their moral wounds or struggling to forgive themselves?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is to talk to other people about it, who you trust and you think are with you. Trusting alliances. It could be your spouse. It could be your buddy who is a little bit more connected than you two to a VA or to the right kind of therapist. It could be a chaplain. In uniform, out of uniform, it don't matter. It could be in a classroom. I can't tell you. The classroom is a pretty privileged relationship. 4 years with someone, if you find someone in your freshman year you like, and you after office hours can be remarkable. Not necessarily for doing therapy, just getting to know someone and someone being able to make referrals. So the first thing is to get it out of you and inside you and talk and find persons who are good listeners and who may also help you navigate bureaucracy if you gotta get referrals. Many of us just aren't psychologically minded. I mean, and that's the brightest, the most intelligent, and the most well-positioned people often just don't see psychological anguish. They think, oh, he's failing a test, or, oh, he's, you know, imagining things. But try to find that person in your community who can make the right referrals.
What kinds of practical things can civilians do to reach out to veterans to help them with their moral wounds?
Well, the first thing you can do is, if you know a veteran in your workplace, in your neighborhood, in your whatever community, you talk. You don't ask questions like about killing or about shots or that sort of thing, but you really sort of say, what was it like for you? How is it coming home? What'd you see? How's it been for your family? You go out for coffee, you go out for a drink, you know, just real engagement and not pussyfooting around with a kind of game of tag. Thank you for your service, and then you move on. I'll buy you a cup of coffee. But really, just having a conversation. I think that's huge. And then getting to know where the services are. Who can you refer someone to if it comes up? What services in your area? There's a proliferation of services now. So every regional area has VA outreach or non-governmental setups, and knowing your friends who are therapists or the like and who can start making referrals. I think that's really what you do. I mean, I can't tell you how many my children have been at campuses, and they don't even ask, and so I'm educating them, and they're my kids.
Well, I want to thank you very much for opening up our eyes to this issue. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Joy. It was a pleasure.
Nancy Sherman is author of After War, Healing the Moral Wounds of Our Soldiers. Nancy Sherman, also a university professor at Georgetown University Department of Philosophy. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Caleb Lado for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, it's time for an all questions answered edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be here to answer your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.